This is a special report from NPR News. The House of Representatives is debating a proposed resolution disagreeing with President Bush's troop increase in Iraq. This has been the second day of debate. I'm Paul Brown. House Concurrent Resolution 63 may take issue with the troop surge, but it also specifically supports American troops. It does not address the controversial issue of funding for troops or the war. On this second day, the basic positions of those supporting and opposing the resolution came out again. All 435 members of the House have the opportunity to speak, so we're hearing some positions restated, but there was also something new, Republicans in support of the resolution, and we'll hear from them shortly. First, House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer of Maryland, who laid out the position of those supporting the resolution.
I oppose the president's plan for several reasons. First, we simply cannot ignore that many miscalculations made by the administration about this war, from sending too few troops, to grossly underestimating the cost, to failing to properly plan for the post-war period. The president repeatedly said that his policies were working. He was tragically wrong, just as he is wrong today, in my view, about this escalation. Secondly, this troop escalation does not represent a new strategy. In fact, we have tried at least four escalations in the past, none of which has succeeded in quelling violence. The time for more troops was 4 years ago, 3 years ago, perhaps even 2 years ago, but not today. The fact is, our commitment of forces has never been commensurate with the risk the president says exists. Never has the president, the commander-in-chief, suggested the resources necessary to succeed. This is too little, tragically too late.
That was Majority Leader Steny Hoyer, a Democrat from Maryland. Republican John Carter of Texas expressed his fear that failure to win in Iraq would bring the war against terrorism directly onto U.S. soil. It's a theme Republicans have come back to repeatedly since debate began.
We, as we make this decision, should realize that what we may be doing is bringing this fight to the very people we're here to represent, so that when we stand in those metal detector lines at our malls, we will know it all started with HCR 63. And now we live in the unsafe world that the Israelis live in every day. Mr. Speaker, the relief sought here today is minimal. This action does nothing to help our troops or help our effort. And the only solution, if it goes bad, is prayer. We have a chance to have a solution here today. And I would submit that solution is vote against House Concurrent Resolution 63.
That's Republican John Carter of Texas. His Republican colleague from Texas, Mac Thornberry, acknowledged problems with the U.S. involvement in Iraq, but he said the resolution will not fix them.
Mistakes have clearly been made with regard to our involvement in Iraq, and members should be part of a serious study to learn from them. There are a good many questions that need to be asked, and there is very good reason for skepticism that this new strategy is really going to work. We should ask those questions. We should hold Iraqis accountable for doing what they say they're going to do. I know there are some people who say we don't need to ask any more questions. They've already made up their mind. They're ready to vote to leave today. Fine, let's vote on that. It's a serious vote with consequences. And people that vote that way ought to be ready to shoulder the responsibility for the consequences that come from that sort of vote. But this resolution is not serious. It's just political posturing, pure and simple.
That's Mac Thornberry, a Republican from Texas. On this second day of debate in the House of Representatives, for the first time, some Republicans spoke in favor of the Iraq resolution. Among them, the Republican co-sponsor of the measure, Walter Jones of North Carolina. He accused his fellow Republicans of being inconsistent.
I remember in 1999 when we were on the floor as a majority party criticizing President Clinton for going into Bosnia. That was a non-binding resolution. That is what the Congress is about. Debate, disagreements, agreement, debate. That is our constitutional responsibility. Let me tell you what Karen Hughes, who was speaking for then Governor Bush, who is now President Bush, what she said about the non-binding resolution. And I quote, this was in the Washington Post, March 27, 1999. I quote Mrs. Hughes, speaking for Governor Bush at the time, criticizing President Clinton, and this is a quote, "If we are going to commit American troops, we must be certain that they have a clear mission, an achievable goal, and an exit strategy."
That's Republican Walter Jones of North Carolina, a co-sponsor of the House resolution opposing President Bush's troop increase in Iraq. The resolution also expresses support for the troops. Congressman Jones yielded the floor to his Republican colleague, Howard Coble, also of North Carolina, and also a supporter of the resolution.
"I regret that we were inept in formulating a post-interest strategy. I'm not convinced that any particular strategy was ever in place. It is unfortunate and, yes, unfair that many people, strike that, some people, perhaps many people, are blaming President Bush, the United States, Great Britain, Australia, and our other allies for the civil unrest in Iraq. Saddam was removed and a free election was conducted. So the Iraqi people were given a choice between freedom and civil war. Unfortunately, they chose the latter. They rejected freedom and chose civil war. And the longer we maintain a presence there, the more they will rely upon us. The time has come, in my opinion, for the baton to be handed to the Iraqis. Finally, permit me to discuss cutting and running." "Oh, you cannot leave. You'll be accused of cutting and running, we're told." "If we had removed Saddam, which most Iraqis wanted, and then withdrew 4 or 5 weeks later, or even 4 or 5 months later, that would have constituted cutting and running. But we've been there for years, Mr. Speaker. Over 3,100 of our troops have given the ultimate sacrifice. In excess of 25,000 have suffered injuries, many permanent disabling injuries. This is sacrifice, not cutting and running. And I insist that we do not maintain an eternal presence in Iraq, if for no other reason than the cost to the taxpayers, which has been astronomically unbelievable. In excess of 2 years, Mr. Speaker, I have stressed the importance of retaining troop withdrawal as a viable option. Early on, virtually no one was even remotely considering withdrawal. I believe withdrawal is not unsound for the reasons I've previously cited. Some Americans, and perhaps some in this body, oppose the Iraqi operation because they dislike President Bush. I, however, do not march to that drum. I am personally very high on President Bush, but on the matter of troop escalation, I am not in agreement. The noted British statesman Edmund Burke, while addressing solicitors at Bristol many years ago, said, "As your representative, I owe you my industry, but I also owe you my judgment. And if I sacrifice my judgment for your opinion," he said, "I have not served you well." Some of my constituents will embrace my vote as demonstrating sound judgment. Others likely will reject my vote as a result of flawed judgment. Not only do I owe my best judgment to my constituents, but to our troops as well, whom we continue to remember in our thoughts and prayers."
That's Congressman Howard Coble of North Carolina. He's one of several Republicans who spoke in favor of the House resolution opposing President Bush's troop increase in Iraq. Statements from Republicans such as Coble may put the president under a little pressure, but he shows no sign he would reconsider the troop surge. Mr. Bush had indicated he was too busy to take in the House floor yesterday, but he did refer to it in a news conference on this second day of debate, and he used the opportunity to push Congress to continue to fund the war effort.
Later this week, the House of Representatives will vote on a resolution that opposes our new plan in Iraq before it has a chance to work. People are prejudging the outcome of this. They have every right to express their opinion.
and it is a non-binding resolution. Soon Congress is going to be able to vote on a piece of legislation that is binding, a bill providing emergency funding for our troops. Our troops are counting on their elected leaders in Washington, D.C., to provide them with the support they need to do their mission. We have a responsibility, all of us here in Washington, to make sure that our men and women in uniform have the resources and the flexibility they need to prevail.
That was President Bush at his White House news conference today. Joining us now, NPR intelligence correspondent Mary Louise Kelly. And Mary Louise, it seems as though the president is already trying to look past this House debate and past the resolution. Is he the only one?
Hello, Paul. No, he's not, not by a long stretch. It does appear as though the real fight is still ahead, and that is when the war spending bill comes up. Now, the Democrats are not going to want to be seen as failing to support the troops, as the president hinted there, so that doesn't look as though they're going to push to actually cut funding. But it does look as though they're going to try to attach language to that bill that would limit future deployments in Iraq, might begin the road toward bringing troops home, might bar, for example, financing of permanent bases in Iraq, for example. So that's where the Democrats are going to be. Republicans, most of whom do back the surge and most of whom do back the president on this, are likely to fight hard against tying the president's hands in that way. It's interesting, you know, the president, as we heard there, was making the point about this week's resolution being non-binding, which is a point of contention actually both for Republicans, many of them, and for many liberal Democrats, a rare point of agreement between those two camps. They both criticized the resolution this week because it's non-binding, and as they see it, toothless, maybe a waste of time. The liberal wing of the Democrats would like to see a binding resolution cutting off funding to U.S. troops, and I would like to see binding action to stop the war, and Republicans would like to see, for the most part, binding action to bar cutting off funding to U.S. troops. So there you go.
We'll be back in just a moment after a break. Thanks, NPR's Mary Louise Kelly. This is an NPR special report on the debate in the House of Representatives over a resolution opposing a troop increase in Iraq. This is a special report from NPR on the House debate over a proposed Iraq resolution. I'm Paul Brown. The resolution expresses support for troops but disapproves of President Bush's troop increase in Iraq. A recurring theme among Republicans opposed to this resolution has been the nature of the war in Iraq. These Republicans say that much more is at stake than Iraq itself. Although Iraq was not connected to the 9/11 terrorist attacks of 2001, these Republicans say it has become a locus of terrorist activity since the U.S. invasion, and that therefore the U.S. cannot abandon its mission there. Zach Womp is a Republican from Tennessee. He said Islamist radicals want to create a huge empire, one that he said would threaten the security of the United States and other countries.
It's important to remember this. We're at war with Islamic jihadists. Zarqawi and Zawahiri were talking while Zarqawi was still alive, and he said we need to expand the caliphate from Indonesia to Morocco. They believe they can go north to Europe and all the way to the former Soviet Union. This is where the Arabs have had influence. This is their agenda. Interesting to me that this only became very difficult in the last 12 months in Iraq. This week was the one-year anniversary of the Samarra Mosque bombing. That's when the sectarian violence broke out. They're attacking each other. Al-Sadr, Muqtada al-Sadr's uncle, is buried at that mosque. He was killed by Saddam Hussein. 1 year ago, they blew up that mosque in the sectarian violence. What is Muqtada al-Sadr doing today? He's fleeing. Why? Because he hears that we're going to increase security, put more boots on the ground in Baghdad. He's fleeing to Iran. What does that say about all this? Well, it says to me that we're beginning to do the right thing. The region's leaders told us this week, partition of Iraq is not acceptable in the Arab world or the Persian world or the region. A partition will not work. It will make things worse. They also said, quote, a precipitous withdrawal will be catastrophic. I remind my colleagues and the American people, we were not in Iraq before September the 11th. We were not in Afghanistan before September the 11th. This problem is not going to go away if we leave Iraq. This is a generational challenge. As a matter of fact, I'll say this, and this may be the most dramatic thing said on this floor, and I'm briefed at a pretty high level. I believe we haven't been attacked domestically since September the 11th for two reasons. One, we're better than we've ever been at intelligence again, and I'm glad. Two, they don't want to see us united like they saw us after September the 11th. Our enemies love the dissent and the division. They do not want to see us come together again because when we do, we are the best in the world.
That's Republican Zach Wamp of Tennessee saying the U.S. must remain in Iraq to defeat Islamist radicals. Marsha Blackburn is another Republican from Tennessee.
The Islamic radicals did get a toehold in Iran in the late 70s. With the approach at that point by President Carter, then President Carter, and those around him. And now those radicals tell us that Iraq is indeed the central front in the global war on terror. We know that they want to change the Middle East, and then they want to change the world. And, Mr. Speaker, that is not the type of change that we want. I want my children and grandchildren to live in freedom. I want them to know an America that is free and strong and independent.
Representative Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee saying that not only President Bush, but Islamist radicals claim Iraq is the central front of the war on terrorism and that the U.S. cannot retreat from there. And Republican John Shadegg of Arizona cast the entire debate in terms of the future of the American way of life in the face of a mortal enemy.
This debate ought to be about more than just Iraq. Indeed, that it is about the worldwide jihadist movement to attack us. I have argued and quoted many jihadist leaders who have said their goal isn't just to win in Iraq, but to take that fight to Westerners and, in their term, unbelievers throughout the world. But I am not alone in that view. This is the language of the National Intelligence Estimate written last April, and it warns America in very simple terms. It sets the case forward in two clear sentences, which I hope all of my colleagues have read and thought through. The first sentence is, "We assess that perceived jihadist success in Iraq would inspire more fighters to continue the struggle elsewhere." What does that tell you? If they are successful, if the jihadists who hate us in Iraq are successful there, they will carry that struggle on elsewhere. Ask yourself, where is elsewhere? I would suggest to you, elsewhere is Great Britain. I would suggest to you, elsewhere is Japan. I would suggest to you, elsewhere is the United States of America and the streets of your hometown.
That's Republican John Shadegg of Arizona. Here again is NPR intelligence correspondent Mary Louise Kelly. Mary Louise, thanks for coming in.
Hey, Paul.
Mary Louise, there's certainly a theme here among these Republicans, and it's the second day we've heard this.
That's right. I think what you're hearing is the Republican strategy in this debate playing out in quite a coherent manner, the same words, the same things echoing over and over. The Republican strategy, as I can make it out, is to cast this debate not as a debate on this resolution per se, but as a debate on the way forward in the wider war on terror. Here's an interesting thing to note. Yesterday, two Republicans, Pete Hoekstra of Michigan and John Shadegg of Arizona, who we just heard from, circulated a letter among lawmakers. And here's one line from it, the key line, which I'll quote. "If we let the Democrats force us into a debate on the surge or on the current situation in Iraq, we lose," end quote. So instead, Republicans appear to be framing the Iraq war as a key battle in a generational global struggle. We heard that language from Zach Wamp there, who was talking about a generational challenge. And the central question, as you raised a moment ago here, is Iraq a front in the war on terror? Now, President Bush has said it is. We're hearing many Republicans echo that on the floor of the House. Democrats see this whole thing quite differently. They see Iraq as a distraction from the wider war on terror. In fact, distraction is maybe not a strong enough word. They see it as a dangerous diversion. And they say that resources that should be going after bin Laden should be going after core al-Qaeda leaders who appear to be holed up along the Afghan-Pakistan border are going instead toward this, you know, as they see it, a bottomless black hole in Iraq that's sapping up all of the resources. So Democrats are using that theory to make the case that Iraq is a case where U.S. forces are getting sucked in essentially to referee a civil war.
From what you know, do significant numbers of the various fighters in Iraq share the agenda that Congressman Shattuck describes?
It's a little unclear. Certainly core al-Qaeda leaders, Osama bin Laden, his deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri, they don't appear to be in Iraq, but they would share this philosophy, and they've said as much. They've said their goal is to restore the caliphate. We heard that word. They want to restore Islam to the point of its great glory 1,300 years ago, and they want to see a single Muslim community that stretches, we were hearing, from the North Atlantic, from Spain, all the way over to East Asia. That is how those senior al-Qaeda leaders think. The question is how many of the fighters in Iraq today are buying into that, how many of them are actually focused on a global, very ambitious agenda, and how many of them are focused much more narrowly on what's going on inside Iraq today. I mean, we do know, particularly with the death of Zarqawi, that the fighting in Iraq is much less driven by foreign fighters and foreign agendas, appears to be much more driven, more and more, by Iraqi fighters with presumably a more domestic agenda.
NPR's Mary Louise Kelly. Democrats have been rejecting the worldview of these Republicans we've just heard from, like Congressman Shattuck. Here's Democratic Congressman Rob Andrews of New Jersey.
The administration persists in rhetoric that defines the conflict in Iraq as a struggle between forces of civilization on one hand and the forces which wrought September 11th on the other. To some extent, this characterization is accurate. But to a great extent, this characterization is inaccurate. A significant portion of the violence in Iraq is not the result of Islamic violence against American troops, although it exists. A significant portion of the violence in Iraq is the result of sectarian violence, Shia against Sunni, Sunni against Shia, and occasionally others against the Kurds. This is not the position of the Democratic Party. This is the observation of the military and intelligence leadership in public documents of this country. Sectarian violence is the principal problem in Iraq. If the problem in Iraq were that a fragile but legitimate young government was struggling to hang on but could not overcome the resistance, then this idea of a troop surge would make sense. The idea of sending more fighters to defeat the resistance would make sense. This is not the proper definition of the problem. The troop surge does not send more fighters to defeat the resistance. It sends more referees to inject themselves into the violence between Shia and Sunni militia and war fighters.
That's Democratic Congressman Rob Andrews of New Jersey. Mary Louise Kelly, Congressman Andrews says his worldview is shared by the intelligence leadership. Now, is it?
I think he has a legitimate case there. I suspect that he is alluding to the latest national intelligence estimate on Iraq, which just came out a couple of weeks ago, at least in part. And if you look at that, it does not discount ongoing insurgent attacks against U.S. forces, but it does focus on sectarian violence, Sunni on Shia, Shia on Sunni, Shia on Shia, really looking at intra-Iraqi violence. It focuses very much on the scale and scope of sectarian conflict inside Iraq.
We also heard from Democratic Congressman Joe Sestak of Pennsylvania. He's a recently retired three-star Navy admiral who served in Afghanistan and in precursor operations to the war in Iraq.
My experience leads me to be concerned for U.S. security because of Iraq, a tragic misadventure that does not permit us to best address more important security challenges throughout this world. My experience also says don't double down on a bad military bet by using more troops as the president has proposed when an increase has not worked before. Have confidence in our diplomatic ability to lead regional negotiations for stability, even with Syria and Iran. And set a date certain for redeploying out of Iraq this year to serve as the necessary leverage to have the Iraqis accept the reality of the personal consequence of not assuming responsibility for their nation. What concerns me about Iraq is the continuing use of our national treasure in what is an inconclusive, open-ended involvement within a country where the long-term benefits do not match what we need to reap, and where the trade-offs and benefits of not focusing elsewhere is harming our future prosperity, interest, and values. We need to apply our resources elsewhere in the world, where terrorists come from, including Osama bin Laden, who is still on the loose. And where emerging nations, such as in the Western Pacific, have growing political and economic interest, and therefore influence that may challenge ours. An alternative strategy is just what is needed, because remaining in Iraq means less security and a greater strategic security risk for America. It negatively impacts the readiness of our armed forces and hinders our ability to adequately focus on other security priorities here at home and throughout the world.
That was Democrat Joe Sestak of Pennsylvania, who supports the House resolution that disapproves of President Bush's troop increase in Iraq. Here's another Democrat, Joe Courtney of Connecticut. He's concerned about the welfare of troops and where additional troops will come from.
Opponents of today's resolution are claiming that it will damage our troops' morale. As a member of the Armed Services Committee, I believe the opposite is true. Let us be very clear about where the 20,000 new troops will come from. President Bush cannot simply dial 911 and 20,000 new fresh troops appear. This escalation can only happen by extending the deployments of soldiers already in Iraq beyond their promised commitments or accelerating the arrival of pre-existing rotations. Upon close examination, it is clear that the impact of this surge lands squarely on the backs of our men and women in uniform who have already borne an unfair burden.
Congressman Joe Courtney of Connecticut, let's hear briefly from a Democrat who has been resolutely against the war from the beginning. Dennis Kucinich of Ohio is running for the Democratic nomination for president, as he did in 2004.
As we debate this non-binding resolution on Iraq, the administration is preparing for the next war in Iran.
Mary Louise Kelly, is that claim true from what you know?
Well, President Bush says no. He always answers this question in very careful language, says that the U.S. is pursuing a diplomatic track with Iran.
Right.
But then he also very quickly adds all options are on the table. So it's undeniable that in the past few weeks we have heard ratcheted up rhetoric from the president, from his advisors, military, intelligence advisors, diplomatic. The question is, what's driving that rhetoric? What is the strategy here? And the truth is, we don't know. It's not clear that a decision has been made one way or the other. Key questions are, does the intelligence support the rhetoric that we're hearing? If it does, they haven't made that intelligence public yet.
Today at his news conference, the president was asked about Iran and information that his administration has been giving out. The administration has claimed the Iranian government appears to be supplying deadly weapons to Iraqi militias. Now, President Bush talked about Iran's role in Iraq today at his news conference at the White House, and he mentioned an organization called the Quds Force. Now, what's that?
All right. The Quds Force is a branch of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. They operate outside Iran's borders primarily, and they report to Iran's senior religious leaders. So the argument that appears to be being made is that the Quds guys are supplying weapons to fighters in Iraq. They support to Iran's senior leaders. Therefore, Iran's senior leaders must be behind this activity. It appears, though, thus far at least, that appears to be more of a hypothesis than something backed up by rock-solid evidence.
Okay, here's President Bush on the subject of Iranian involvement in Iraq.
I can say with certainty that the Quds Force, a part of the Iranian government, has provided these sophisticated IEDs that have harmed our troops. And I'd like to repeat, I do not know whether or not the Quds Force was ordered from the top echelons of government, but my point is, what's worse, them ordering it and it happening, or them not ordering it and it's happening? And so we will continue to protect our troops. David, our strategy is comprehensive in order to resolve problems that will affect our own peace and the peace in the world. And the biggest problem I see is the Iranians' desire to have a nuclear weapon. And as you know, we've been dealing with this issue ever since you've been covering me and pretty much ever since I've been the president. And we've made it very clear to the Iranians that if they would like to have a dialogue with the United States, there needs to be a verifiable suspension of their program. I would hope that they would do that. I would like to be given a chance for us to explain that we have no desire to harm the Iranian people. But my focus is on making sure that this weapon is dealt with, the program is dealt with in a constructive, peaceful way. And we'll continue to work toward achieving our common objectives with other nations in the world in a peaceful way.
That's President Bush at his news conference today. Mary Louise Kelly, it seems from these comments that despite what some Democrats are saying, the president is unwilling to invade Iran.
Well, Iran is a very difficult case. It's another case similar to the Iraq situation in that there isn't a great answer lurking in the wings for what to do about it. We heard the president allude there to Iran's nuclear program, which is, of course, one of the other big items on the table in U.S.-Iranian relations. The subject of Iran's nuclear ambitions is about to come back before the U.N. Security Council. There is a lot of speculation that perhaps the ratcheted-up rhetoric we are hearing from the Bush administration in recent days is a reflection of the nuclear issue as well, and the administration pushing, really trying to push Iraq and make clear we're not going to tolerate bad behavior. That has been the Bush administration's MO on a number of tough cases, North Korea until quite recently, in which the Bush administration said we're not going to reward bad behavior. And in the case of Iran, they have made clear they're going to show that they are not going to make a first move and to negotiate on certain matters. So I think, you know, it's the president is keenly aware that U.S. forces are stretched very tight in Iraq, in Afghanistan already. What he's going to try to do in his remaining months in office remains to be seen.
Thanks. NPR intelligence correspondent Mary Louise Kelly. This is a special report on the House debate on the Iraq War resolution. The resolution would disapprove of President Bush's troop surge in Iraq. While also expressing support for American troops, it does not address the issue of funding. We'll be back after a short break. This is NPR News. This is an NPR special report on the debate in the House of Representatives over a resolution on Iraq. I'm Paul Brown. The resolution disapproves of the so-called surge in troops to Iraq that has now begun. It also expresses support for the troops. Last year, the bipartisan Iraq Study Group issued a set of recommendations regarding a way forward in Iraq. Critics say the Bush administration has failed to adopt most of them. The study group, headed by former Secretary of State James Baker and former Congressman Lee Hamilton, said a short-term troop surge would be acceptable, if not desirable. In debate today, a number of representatives, both for and against the House resolution, invoked the Iraq Study Group and its recommendations. Here's Republican Wayne Gilchrist of Maryland. He's one of a number of Republicans who spoke today in favor of the resolution.
The blueprint, the starting point, is to vote yes today on today's resolution. The second phase of that is to understand the words, which is the blueprint for this new phase, the Iraq Study Group. What do we do with U.S. troops in the Middle East? There's strong recommendations for that. What do we do about training and equipping the Iraqi army and making them prepared? That's in the Iraq Study Group. What is the framework for cooperation with the Iraq people, the Iraq government, and the problems with sectarian violence? That's in the Iraq Study Group. What about a new diplomatic initiative with all of Iraq's neighbors, including Iran and Syria? How about consultation with Congress? Vote for this resolution, and we can move on to end the violence, the sectarian chaos, the foolish, bitter electronic exchanges between countries, electronic exchanges instead of face-to-face conversations. That effort, fully implemented, will bring our troops home sooner. They will have a brighter future, and the generations to come for the people in Iraq and Afghanistan. We, as members of Congress, are at the controls.
That's Republican Wayne Gilchrist of Maryland, one of the Republicans who's parted company with the president and will vote in favor of the non-binding resolution on the House floor. He says the Iraq Study Group's recommendations should be a blueprint for a phased end to the U.S. involvement in Iraq. Republican Kay Granger of Texas opposes the resolution and backs what the White House has called a new way forward in Iraq, including the troop increase. She also cited the Iraq Study Group.
Many of the speakers at this resolution have cited the widely accepted Iraq Study Group report, which pointed to the dire consequences that America, indeed the world, would face should we fail in Iraq. What they choose to ignore is that the bipartisan authors of this report stipulated that they would agree with a short-term surge of American forces to bolster security and train Iraqi forces, which is precisely what our new strategy does. 2 weeks ago, the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq was published, and it largely concurred with the findings of the study group of the results that failure in Iraq would bring. Retreat from Iraq would result in pervasive instability in the Middle East, encourage rogue regimes, and give terrorists a secure base from which to launch attacks against free nations everywhere. No one disagrees that the situation in Iraq has become more dangerous. But let me be perfectly clear. The consequences of failure in this fight would be catastrophic, not only for America, but for the entire world.
Republican Kay Granger of Texas, echoing themes of many House Republicans over the past 2 days. Michael Castle of Delaware is one of the Republicans who supports the resolution and wants much more in the way of diplomacy.
In December, the bipartisan Iraq Study Group presented a comprehensive blueprint to achieve stability in the region and transfer responsibility over to the Iraqi government, which I have in my hand, and I went back and reread this week. I would encourage everyone to reread it. In my opinion, one of the important recommendations made by the group was to call for a robust diplomatic effort to stabilize Iraq and ease tensions in the region. In fact, some of our nation's greatest military minds, including former Secretary of State Colin Powell, have joined the group in recommending that every country with an interest in averting a chaotic Iraq, including all of Iraq's neighbors, Turkey, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iran, and Syria among them, participate in this important dialogue. The group also recommended that we engage the United Nations Security Council, the European Union, and other international institutions in launching this new diplomatic offensive. The intensive diplomacy recommended by the Iraq Study Group should be familiar to all of us who remember the Cold War. One of the best examples of this approach to diplomacy was evident when a week after President Reagan asked General Secretary Gorbachev to tear down this wall, he sent his administration to Moscow for diplomatic talks. The Iraq Study Group's recommendations are by no means a panacea, but their report does represent a new path forward based on the pragmatic style of diplomacy that helped us win the Cold War. For this reason, I have joined Congressman Frank Wolf and several of my colleagues in introducing legislation that endorses the Iraq Study Group's call for an integrated diplomatic initiative. In focusing on a true strategy for achieving stability in Iraq, this resolution seeks to improve our global standing and concentrate our efforts on funding an endgame based on a genuine commitment to diplomacy. To attain these goals, the Wolf Resolution seeks to lift our debate above the existing political rhetoric and pursue a comprehensive strategy to build regional and international support for stability in Iraq. It is equally crucial that we do everything within our ability to accelerate the training of Iraqi troops and provide them with the resources necessary to assume control of their own destiny.
Representative Michael Castle of Delaware, a number of Republicans expected to vote for the resolution disapproving of the troop increase in Iraq. Democrat Joe Courtney of Connecticut also invoked the Iraq Study Group, and he said both it and the latest national intelligence estimate do not support President Bush's policies.
Despite the huge cost to our troops and our national defense, the president has opted to aggravate the holes in our defense with a plan to escalate the number of troops in Iraq. And for what? Yesterday, I read the new classified national intelligence estimate on Iraq. What I found in this report was the same as the unclassified version that has been reported in the press, that we have a deteriorating security situation in Iraq whose fundamental causes were identified as political, not military. This finding completely dovetails with the findings of the Iraq Study Group, who came to exactly the same conclusion. Instead of absorbing the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group report and the NIE and surging diplomacy and political solutions, the president instead has opted to escalate the war by sending 21,500 more troops in the middle of a violent sectarian conflict.
That's Democratic Congressman Joe Courtney of Connecticut. We're back now with NPR's intelligence correspondent Mary Louise Kelly. And Mary Louise, as I was listening today, it seemed as though people on all sides of this debate have been looking to the Iraq Study Group as a source of wisdom, guidance, and vindication of their views. So what exactly did that group have to say about U.S. troop levels in Iraq?
Well, here's what they actually say. They write, "We could support a short-term redeployment or surge of American combat forces to stabilize Baghdad or to speed up training and equipping missions if the U.S. commander in Iraq determines that such steps would be effective. Let me emphasize the could. We could support this if a U.S. military commander in Iraq thinks it's the right thing to do. They also make the point if the U.S. should not make an open-ended commitment to keep large numbers of American troops in Iraq. I think the bottom line is you can find evidence to support all sorts of points of view in this report. I think an honest reading of it says they didn't come out in favor of a surge. They just said we could live with it.
And we can note that the Bush administration was fairly muted in its reaction to the ISG report. I was wondering if we could talk for a moment about the national intelligence estimate that was mentioned by Congressman Courtney. Do its conclusions point to the need for a troop surge? Congressman Courtney seems to think not.
Well, the NIE didn't actually address this head-on, and it came under some criticism for not doing so. The only option it looked at was rapid withdrawal, and it concluded that the consequences of a rapid U.S. pullout would be catastrophic. But it didn't actually look at what the consequences of a surge might be, and it didn't look at what many Democrats are arguing for, which not a rapid withdrawal, but a gradual phased withdrawal. So it's come under some criticism for that. That said, bear in mind this is an intelligence document. Its job is not to make policy prescriptions. It's to lay out what the situation is there. And again, we heard people, both Republicans and Democrats, quoting from this document. There are bits and pieces of it that you can draw out to support many different arguments about the path forward in Iraq.
And I guess we'll be hearing more of that sort of thing over the next couple of days as the talk continues on the House floor. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly, thanks lots for being with us.
You're welcome, Paul.
Now let's consider the politics of this moment for President Bush. There were Republicans who said today they will support the resolution disapproving the troop buildup in Iraq. You could hear in their voices that they were struggling. Congressman Ron Paul of Texas seemed resigned to an outcome that he feels can't be avoided, and he wants to see an end come to the Iraq involvement sooner rather than later. He placed his arguments partly in constitutional terms and partly in financial terms.
There's no logical reason to reject the restraints placed in the Constitution regarding our engaging in foreign conflicts unrelated to our national security. The advice of the founders and our early presidents was sound then, and it's sound today. We shouldn't wait until our financial system is completely ruined and we are forced to change our ways. We should do it as quickly as possible and stop the carnage and the financial bleeding that will bring us to our knees and eventually force us to stop that which we should have never started. We all know in time the war will be defunded one way or another, and the troops will come home. So why not now?
That's Congressman Ron Paul of Texas, a Republican who favors the resolution against President Bush's Iraq troop siege. Republican John Duncan of Tennessee presented a complex list of reasons for supporting the Iraq resolution.
Most of what we have spent has been purely foreign aid in nature, rebuilding Iraq's infrastructure, giving free medical care, training police, giving jobs to several hundred thousand Iraqis, and on and on and on. Our Constitution does not give us the authority to run another country, as we have in reality been doing in Iraq. With a national debt of almost $9 trillion, we can't afford it. To me, our misadventure in Iraq is both unconstitutional and unaffordable. Some have said it was a mistake to start this war, but that now we are there, we have to, quote, finish the job, and we cannot cut and run. Well, if you find out you're going the wrong way down the interstate, you do not keep going. You get off at the next exit. There is no way, Mr. Speaker, we can keep all of our promises to our own people on Social Security, veterans' benefits, and many other things in the years ahead if we keep trying to run the whole world.
That's Republican Congressman John Duncan of Tennessee. From Virginia, Republican Tom Davis expressed support for President Bush, but frustration at all that has gone wrong in Iraq.
We want the president to succeed, but we're disappointed our hopes and good intentions for Iraq remain unrealized. Many are frustrated by the mistakes and missed opportunities that plagued this noble but star-crossed effort. Poor planning for occupation and reconstruction of a devastated nation and missteps by the coalition provisional authority allowed the insurgency and long-simmering factional hatreds to erupt and to take root. At this point, it seems clear to many that only Iraqi interests, not ours, can be advanced on the streets of Baghdad. U.S. and coalition forces were tasked as protectors of Iraq's hard-won sovereignty, not referees in unchecked sectarian vendettas. From here, the surge looks much more like the status quo on steroids, than a serious alternative policy to reach a realistic goal.
That's Virginia Republican Tom Davis speaking somewhat reluctantly of his support for the Iraq resolution. There were also Republicans who don't endorse the resolution, but they are still uncomfortable with the surge plan advanced by President Bush. Here's Mike Rogers of Michigan.
The simplicity of the resolution concerns me greatly. I'm not in favor of sending American troops, the other 16,000, into the streets of Baghdad to intervene in the sectarian violence. I'm not. I am in favor of supporting the soldiers who've asked and should receive reinforcements fighting al-Qaeda in the West. This resolution really makes no difference in that fight. Makes no difference in the complexities and how we win and get our soldiers home. This resolution does not bring one soldier home. This resolution does not make one soldier safer. This resolution does not bring to justice one terrorist. This resolution offers not one alternative.
Republican Congressman Mike Rogers of Michigan, his Republican colleague Heather Wilson of New Mexico, is also against the resolution, but she too does not entirely buy President Bush's strategy.
The president is sending an additional 20,000 troops to Iraq. The problem isn't the numbers. The problem is the mission and setting the conditions to be able to accomplish that mission. Some of these troops are going to Anbar, and I think that we do need to reinforce our troops in the Sunni heartland to fight al-Qaeda and to make it less likely that they will be welcome there for the long term. But I am skeptical about the Baghdad mission. Operation Together Forward, the effort to secure Baghdad last year, failed. The idea was to clear, hold, and build, but the Iraqi units did not show up in enough numbers to be able to hold what America had cleared. In the early days of this surge in Baghdad, there are too many indications that this will be happening again.
Congresswoman Wilson was also involved in one of the real exchanges today on the floor of the House, a contrast to yesterday when the proceedings seemed to be a succession of speeches. Here, Representative Wilson said the Iraq resolution would signal a failure to support U.S. troops.
The greatest burdens have fallen on the shoulders of a relatively small number of Americans who have volunteered to take great risks on our behalf. As leaders of this nation, this House abdicates its responsibility if we fail to make clear to them that they will have the equipment they need to do the job and come home again.
Democrat Marty Meehan of Massachusetts immediately responded.
With all due respect to my friend from New Mexico, I want to make the point that this resolution does not do anything to stop funding for the troops. As a matter of fact, it was this administration that sent 140,000 troops into harm's way without up-armored Humvees. No, I won't. There's nothing in this to cut funding for the troops. But you can stay as I tell that this administration sent 140,000 troops into harm's way without up-armored Humvees, without Kevlar vests.
Joining us now is NPR's White House correspondent David Greene. David, welcome.
Hi, Paul.
Hey. David, the president had a news conference today. Did he acknowledge those Republicans who were voting for the resolution?
He did, and it was really unusual. Normally, the president doesn't predict votes ahead of time, but he said he knows where Democrats and some Republicans stand, and he really spoke of the vote as a foregone conclusion. He did say, though, that he would like it if more lawmakers gave the plan a chance to work. But for this moment, at least, the president sounded very politically isolated.
He was, David, Iraq was the main issue in the November midterm elections, for sure. Looking forward to 2008, the president doesn't really have a horse in this race. For example, his vice president isn't running. Does that affect his thinking on Iraq?
Yeah, that's a good point. The vice president is not running, and the president's actually talked about that as a plus. He'd rather not have a vice president out there talking about politics, distancing himself from the White House, and Mr. Bush says this gives him the chance to talk about Iraq without thinking about politics. But I think there's a question about how long the president can go when members of his party, looking ahead to 2008, are running away from him. Maybe he can go for a while, but Republican candidates who lost back in last year in 2006 just said that the president didn't give them the opening they needed to tell Americans that there is an end in sight. And the Republicans really feel that's why they did so poorly at the polls.
Just briefly, David, the president has said over and over again that he won't be swayed by Congress in his decisions on Iraq policy. This resolution is expected to pass the House on Friday, though it's non-binding. Do you get any sense that it could cause the president to reconsider his strategy? Occasionally, he's changed course suddenly after saying he won't.
No indication yet, Paul. What the president said today is no matter what members of Congress say and no matter what he says, what's going to really make the difference is what happens on the ground. If things improve, Americans might come to his side. If things don't improve, he's in trouble.
Thanks very much, NPR's White House correspondent David Green.
You're welcome, Paul.
This special report was directed by Gwen Uten, edited by Martha Wexler, and produced by Giselle Grayson with help from Katie Adun and Eamon Malone. The sound engineers were Michael Schweppe and Johnny Vince Evans. Thanks also to NPR's Mary Louise Kelly, our intelligence correspondent. From NPR News in Washington, this has been a special report on the debate in the House of Representatives on a resolution on the war in Iraq. The resolution opposes a troop increase in Iraq and expresses support for troops. I'm Paul Brown.